Take your Bibles this morning and please turn with me to Acts chapter 19. And yes, beloved, I promise you, this is the last message in this portion of Deuteronomy 16, touching the issue of judges and officers. Not because there's nothing more to say, but trying to be a good steward of time and to try to make some progress as we look into Deuteronomy. Got a tear on my page here. Okay, Acts chapter 19. Now, before I read the text, let's do some history. Paul is in the city of Ephesus, and he's going to spend in this third and final missionary journey that's actually recorded in Scripture. He's in Ephesus, and he gets himself in hot water. And if you're preaching the gospel properly, you are going to offend people. Not because you want to be cantankerous. Not even because you've gone out of your way to be cantankerous. Because when you preach the gospel, beloved, there's two sides of the gospel. The bad news and the good news. Now, everyone likes to hear good news. You and I included. We really don't like, nor do we welcome, bad news. But bad news has to come. And that bad news is that we, when we're born into this world, when we're conceived and brought into this world, we come into this world doomed. The wrath of God is already upon us because of our first father who rebelled way back yonder in Genesis chapter 3. We call that nasty thing original sin. And some people don't like being told that. Why am I responsible? Why do I have to bear the burden, even if I do believe in a guy named Adam, for something that he did some 4,000 years ago? Why must I bear that burden? Well, beloved, that's how God set things up. Adam was our human representative, just like Christ on the cross represented the people for whom he died, his elect. We make no apologies for stating it that way. We're in bad shape. We are dead in sins. We are aliens to God's kingdom. We hate God. And there are different degrees of that hatred as it manifests itself in different people's lives. If there's anything of a good hate and a real bad hate, we hate God. We hate His Word. We hate the law of God. We hate the Ten Commandments. We hate being told you need to go to church. We hate being forced to read our Bibles when we're young or memorizing Scripture. We do it kicking and screaming to make mommy and daddy happy, and when I'm 18, I don't need to go to church anymore because I'll run my life my way. Paul got himself in hot water, mainly from a union of men who made statues, idols of Diana. And Paul was hurting their bottom line because the more people who were being converted, were less people going to the temple of Diana, which meant less trinkets and souvenirs being bought at the souvenir stand outside the temple of Diana, which in our Bible study that we're doing, our pastor study twice a month, we're in the book of Ephesus, and we've learned that the temple of Diana that was located in Ephesus was once one of the seven wonders of the world. I mean, that was her headquarters of worship. And so they're going to drag Paul into the arena. The whole town goes ballistic. A riot breaks out. They would have made Black Lives Matter and Antifa very happy. Now, they didn't burn the city and topple statues, but they were in the arena shouting, "Great is Diana! Great is Diana! The whole world worships Diana. She's a doll. She's great." And Paul was minded to go into that arena. That's like a guy going in a nest of sharks. With all that, look at verse 30. "And when Paul would have entered in unto the people, the disciples suffered him not. So the disciples come to Paul's aid and say, 'Paul, this is one fight you ought to retreat.' And certain of the chief of Asia, which were his friends, sent unto him, desiring him that he would not adventure himself into the theater." Notice who is doing this. Chief men of Asia. So Paul had a broad spectrum of friends. Not just a low class. And remember, back in these days, there was no such thing as a middle class. But there were some movers and shakers in Asia that were his friends. Some therefore cried one thing, some another, for the assembly was confused. You see the word assembly here? That's the same Greek word that is translated church elsewhere in your authorized version. That's what a church is. It's not the building, it's not the walls, the pretty stained glass windows, the padded pews, the beautiful pipe organ, not the steeple, and not the shiny gold cross that sparkles in the sun. It's the people. And more part knew not whereof they were come together. That's like most riots today in the street. Half the people that's out there burning and looting and robbing and tearing down statues, they don't have a clue why they're even there. And they drew Alexander out of the multitude, the Jews putting him forward. So out of all the Christians, this poor sap, this poor dude named Alexander, this Christian, he gets hauled into the theater. Alexander beckoned with his hand and would have made his defense unto the people. But when they knew that he was a Jew, all with one voice about the space of 2 hours, can you imagine a riot for 2 constant hours screaming, "Great is Diana of Ephesus." I mean, these people put to shame any football stadium with all the uproaring and all the cheering that might go on in a baseball stadium or a football stadium. These guys, beloved, this was 1 2-hour concert with nothing but one song, "Great is Diana of Ephesus." And when the town clerk, now watch, when the town clerk had appeased the people, so this is a city official, has to be brought into the theater. He hears all this commotion. He has to appease the people. He said, "Ye men of Ephesus, what man is there that knoweth not how that the city of the Ephesians is a worshiper of the great goddess Diana?" Now again, that temple was one of the 7 wonders of the world. "And the image which fell down from Jupiter." Now there must be some type of a legend referring to something that fell out of the sky. Probably maybe a meteorite. Now, back in those days, people were quite superstitious, just like people are today. Something fell out of the sky, and they attributed it to Jupiter. Now, that's the Roman equivalent to Jupiter is the Greek Zeus. They're one and the same. One's a Roman name, the other's a Greek name. Zeus, Jupiter, same god. Okay? So they attributed that this thing that came out of the sky to Jupiter. "Seeing then that these things cannot be spoken against." So this man in his mind had this legend of this thing coming out of the sky, and wherever it fell, maybe that's where they built this temple. "Ye ought to be quiet and to do nothing rashly. For ye have brought hither these men, which are neither robbers of churches, nor yet blasphemers of your goddess. Wherefore, if Demetrius and the craftsmen," that's the union, "which are with him, have a matter against any man," watch, "the law is open, and there are deputies, let them implead one another." Judges. We're talking politics here. Now, in our pastor study, not only did we learn that Ephesus was the place of one of the 7 wonders of the world, the temple to Diana, there are 2 things also mentioned about Ephesus at this time. Number one, it was a free city, and therefore no Roman soldiers were garrisoned. And secondly, we learned in our pastor study that Ephesus was the key location for all courtroom proceedings in that part of Asia. Notice what the clerk says. If Demetrius and his union have an issue, notice, the law is open. And we got deputies. But if ye inquire anything concerning other matters. Notice, the town's clerk says, if you bring up anything else, it shall be determined, notice, in a lawful assembly, not a mob. For we are in danger to be called in question this day's uproar, there being no cause whereby we may give an account of this concourse. And when he had thus spoken, he told them to go home. Why does Luke bring in politics and religion? You find both in this particular account. You got true religion against false religion, right? And you got a mob out of control, and the town's guy says, what? Whoa, if you have a grievance, court is in session. The law is open. And what did we find in our pastor study? Diana's temple, one of the seven wonders. Secondly, it was a free city. No Roman soldiers were there garrisoned. And above all, it was the key location to bring any legal grievance in that part of the ancient world. How are them apples? Wow. Now, in the previous hour, we considered, you don't need to turn there, 2 Chronicles 19, 1-7, where Jehoshaphat is confronted by the prophet who tells him, are we going to twist judgment here? Are we going to take bribes and look the other way? And so Joshua puts his feet on the ground and begins to do basically a national revival, a national renewal from top to bottom. This was not something that was generated at ground level and then worked its way up into the palace. This came directly from the palace to the people, top down, not bottom up. And he begins to get rid of all the groves and all the idols. And we're going to find that out in our next installments with the two closing verses of Deuteronomy 16. You're going to find this very interesting, the topic that we're going to bring up. He does all that. And then he had to take to task the fact that by the time he comes to the throne and by the time this prophet nails him to the wall, the judicial system of his country, of his two tribes, needed reform. Not just anyone, but people that you know. People who have certain characteristics, certain qualities, who were going to judge righteously. And to hear both sides, whether it was a Jew or whether it was a stranger living amongst them, they were to hear both sides of an issue before making any determination. And what else is the law of Moses? What is the principle? We even find that even in church discipline. Wherever two or three are gathered, there I am in the midst of them. That's found in the context of church discipline, not just simply showing up for church. But in the Old Testament, in the mouth of two or three witnesses shall everything be established. You don't just simply send someone to the gallows because of one testimony. You have to have a body of evidence that's going to substantiate any plea of guilty and any appropriate punishment. Okay? Are you with me so far? And then we looked the last hour at Deuteronomy 1, 9-18, where Moses recalls that encounter that we're studying about in Deuteronomy 16, which harkens back to Jethro's advice to his son-in-law about spreading out the wealth. Let the judges that you pick with these qualifications, let them take care of the little nicknoy issues, major issues, maybe like life and death, capital punishment, a Sabbath breaker, someone caught kneeling down to an idol, like idolatry or adultery, whatever, things of that nature. Okay, well, with that in mind, let's now turn to Deuteronomy 25. Deuteronomy 25. Deuteronomy 25. And listen to verses 1 to 3. Notice this little installment in the law of Moses here. Deuteronomy chapter 25, look at verses 1 to 3, and we have like an example. Okay? If there be a controversy between men, okay, and they come unto judgment, all right, that the judges may judge them. Then they shall justify the righteous and condemn the wicked. So notice, once again, going all the way even back to Romans 13, the powers that be, they bear the sword not in vain. What is their primary responsibility? Not to make people's lives miserable or tax them to death. Human government's responsibility is made here in a nutshell. Vindicate and justify those who are righteous in their appeal, and to condemn or to punish the guilty. That is the prime reason for human government. Now, you and I know right now, living in the year 2023, our form of government, though beautiful on paper, has now become a monster. A very vicious monster. I'll go one step further, a very deadly monster. It's a totalitarian monster that can lie to us, instill fear and intimidation, cause us to do things against our freedoms, all in the name of safety and love. But this here, in that verse 1, is quite simple. You got a controversy. Everybody here, those of you listening to me, you got a brain, you got a mind, you can think for yourself. You have an issue between men. And they come to judgment. Who are they coming to? The judges. And what is the ultimate goal of any judge? Vindicate the innocent, punish the guilty. And it shall be, if the wicked man be worthy to be beaten, that the judge shall cause him to lie down and to be beat before his face according to his fault by a certain number. 40 stripes he may give him and not exceed, lest if he should exceed and beat him above these with many stripes, then thy brother should seem vile unto thee. What does Paul say of himself? Several times he was beaten. 40 stripes minus one. When he gave a laundry list of his struggles and his temptations and his trials. On one occasion, he was stoned to death and dragged out of the city and left for dead. Several times, he bobbed in the Mediterranean Sea. Spent a few times in prison. Chased out of town. But he does mention being beat. And the Jewish law was 40 stripes minus one, compassion. Now notice, he was to be beat in front of the judge, in front of the judge's face. Why? The judge was the one who sentenced him. And thus the judge was to preside even over the punishment that was dished out. So what do we learn here as we close? Well, first off, you have a controversy between two parties. Secondly, this controversy gets out of control to the point there's no reconciliation. There's no satisfaction. Things are apparently getting hot and heavy. And you don't want to have a riot. You don't want to have some type of crime worse than the controversy committed, like someone killing another person or robbing them or damaging their property, maybe taking the wheel off their chariot. Okay, like scraping someone's car today, we'll take a wheel off of his chariot. What did Samson do on one occasion? He burned a whole field of crops, tying foxes tail to tail, and putting a firebrand and letting them loose out there in the field. Burnt the entire field. They can burn a guy's crops. He loses a lot of money. So before this controversy gets out of kilter, let's go before the law. What did we read in Acts 19? Hey guys, we know Diana's great. She's beautiful. She's marvelous. She was known to have 100 breasts protruding from her chest. Goddess of fertility. The god of life. We know she's cool. But the law is open. You can sign up right now. And we got deputies waiting. They got something to do today. You want a hearing? Bring it on. And apparently they didn't want to go that far. And what did he tell them? Go home. Go home. Go home. Next, in verse 1, we have either two outcomes. Justify the righteous, the one who was in the right, the one who was not guilty of any offense or any crime, under the law. Or condemn the wicked, the guilty, the one who did whatever, under reasonable, beyond reasonable doubt, under law. Law, law, law. Not mob. Like in Acts 19. That was a mob. And if they brought Alexander into that theater, no telling what would have happened to him. That's why those who were rich and famous in Asia told Paul, don't go in. They restrained him. They would have tore Paul apart. Especially the goldsmiths and the ones making the little knickknacks for the souvenir shop outside Diana's temple. They would have ate him up. When he goes to Jerusalem after this 3-year stint in Ephesus, when he goes to Jerusalem, you need a Roman soldiers to get in there to save Paul from the Jews who wanted to eat him up. And then Paul's going to spend 2 years in that part of the world, standing before other Roman dignitaries, giving account, giving his testimony, languishing in prison and such, until finally he makes his appeal to Caesar. Are you with me? Then verses 2 to 3, the administration of punishment, as prescribed under what? Law. Under the law. Under the law. Now, consider what's now written in Numbers 15. Numbers chapter 15. And when you look at America's legal system in its creation, when this nation comes together, beloved, your founding fathers were quite aware of all of this information, because our founding fathers were more versed in the Bible than many pastors are today. And much of our penal code is drawn out of the principles of the Old and New Testament. Now all that's being overturned right now by the current regime. Numbers chapter 15, look at verse 27, friends. And if any soul sin through ignorance, now this is beautiful, then he shall bring a she-goat of the first year for a sin offering. So here's a situation where somebody sins without knowing what he did was a sin. Now, is that possible today? Yes. That's possible. Our society is so secular today. Beloved, we live in a culture that is no different from Athens. We no longer live in Jerusalem. We live in Athens, to quote Ken Ham, Answers in Genesis, founder. We're no different than the Athenians on Mars's Hill when it comes to our culture. Beloved, we got several generations of young people raised in public school indoctrination. They don't even know that there's a God. Mom and dad don't go to church. These children don't go to church. They may not even know who the 12 apostles are, let alone what the 10 commandments say. They're ignorant. They're pagans. We have raised several generations of barbarians, courtesy of the public school indoctrination system, which your taxes feed. Is it possible for children today to commit something without realizing that in God's eyes it's wrong? Yeah. And here's a provision. You got to admit, these people to whom Moses is talking, they're not baboons. They knew the law. And yet we have an instance where a soul sins not knowing. Well, he's to bring an offering. The priest shall make an atonement for the soul that sinneth ignorantly, when he sinned by ignorance before the Lord. Now, I didn't write that. But here's an instance of a sin committed by this poor soul before the face of God without the person knowing, to make an atonement for him, and he shall be forgiven him. Ye shall have one law for him that sinned through ignorance, both for him that is born among the children of Israel and for the stranger that sojourneth among you. Ooh. So this law applied to a non-Jew, like a Rahab, like a Ruth, the Syrophoenician woman of the Old Testament that Jesus refers to. Wow. But the soul that doeth aught presumptuously, this is the person that knows what not to do but does it anyway, whether he be born in the land or a stranger, the same reproacheth the Lord, and that soul shall be cut off from among his people, because he hath despised the word of the Lord and hath broken his commandment. That soul shall utterly be cut off, his iniquity shall be upon him. Death penalty. That's not excommunication where he's banished out there in the wilderness. If you look at the Hebrew wording, cut off, that's what it means. Death. Wow. Consider what is written here. You have guilt because of ignorance versus guilt by knowledge, but sin nonetheless. In either case, it had to be atoned for under the law. Now notice of this distinction. The sin of ignorance, the sin of presumption, the sin of not knowing versus the sin of knowing and trampling. Notice that difference. You take this and now turn to Luke 12. As you can see, beloved, this is no small issue. And even though it's only a few lines in Deuteronomy 16, we're kind of seeing kind of a broad view of how what we're studying in Deuteronomy affects us even today. Look at Luke 12, verse 41. Luke 12, 41. Then Peter said unto him, Lord, speakest thou this parable unto us, or even to all? The Lord said, Who then is that faithful and wise steward? So Jesus gives this parable about a wise and faithful steward, the concept of stewardship and responsibility and accountability, whom his Lord shall make ruler over his household, to give them their portion of meat in due season. Blessed is that servant whom the Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Of a truth, I say unto you that he will make him ruler over all that he hath. But, and if that servant say in his heart, My Lord delayeth his coming, and you're kind of wondering what coming here Jesus is referring to, and shall begin to beat the men servants and maids, and to eat and drink and to be drunken, the Lord of that servant will come in a day when he looketh not for him. Sounds very similar to the Olivet Discourse. He's going to come like a thief in the night. And at an hour when he's not aware, and will cut him asunder, and will appoint him his portion with the unbelievers. And that servant, watch, which knew, underline, knew his Lord's will, and prepared not himself, neither did according to his master's will, shall be beat with many stripes. Now watch where Jesus makes even this distinction. But he that knew not, that's ignorance, and did commit things worthy of stripes, shall be beaten with few. For unto whomsoever much is given, of him shall be much required. And to whom men have committed much, of him they will ask the more. So notice how you take Numbers 15, and you find this stipulation granted in the law of Moses, of the sin committed in ignorance by some poor soul that doesn't know. But he did it in front of the Lord. That's what the verse says. He does it before the Lord, and then eventually it's brought to his or her attention. He's to make an atonement. On the other hand, the individual who knew his Lord's will, full knowledge, and with presumption, transgress, walks over that line under the law of Moses, he was to be killed. He was to be stoned. He was to be cut off from his people. Now turn to Matthew chapter 18. And I think all of us know where we're going. Matthew chapter 18. Let's look on keeping a church family clean from within and unified from within. This passage, Matthew 18, 15 to 20, is a passage that has been brutally abused by the self-righteous of heart. Any of you that have been on the receiving end of church discipline, whether you were guilty or not, I would imagine for many who went through this process, it all depends who is the ones doing the final process in this particular three-tier structure that Jesus lays down, as we shall see here in a moment. In most cases, in most churches, it's simply used to get rid of someone because they know too much. You got to get rid of them, especially if it deals with the finances of the church and the leadership of the church has their hands in the cookie jar where it ought not to be, and funds are being embezzled or being used poorly, and someone comes to light with that and they expose that. They got to go. We got to get rid of him or her. So you find some charge, and then the leadership hypes up the church against them. Beloved, we saw that for the past 2 or 3 years in America. Anybody who spoke out against any of the stupidity of lockdown, masks, and forced vaccines, if anybody even brought any dissent to that narrative, they were shot down. Their accounts were taken off of Twitter and off of Facebook. Whatever they posted on YouTube was gone, as if it never existed. And nobody in the news media was even voicing any dissent, because they were all being paid by Big Pharma. I'm not going to speak against the person who's putting money in my back pocket. I got that trip to the Bahamas scheduled this summer. Same thing in church discipline. And then there were those who overstepped church discipline by telling everybody in the church what needs to go on with that particular person or that particular family. Well, let's see what Jesus said. Ready? Verse 15. Moreover, if thy brother shall trespass against thee. So we have the same situation as in the Old Testament. You got a controversy between two parties. Go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone. And here in my notes, this is the first abuse that's automatically done. The one who's been offended, he sends off his emails to everybody in the church about his grievance. He wants them to know that his feathers have been ruffled. Too chicken to go face his supposed offender. By God, behind us on a keyboard in front of a screen, you can be bold. You can be brash. And you could be downright evil. Clickety-click, clickety-click, hit send. Bible says, Jesus says, if there's a problem with someone, they've done something or whatever, ruffled your feathers, rattled your cage, him alone. Not him alone in a bunch of emails. Once you do that, the person who's doing that has already violated this procedure. And as far as I'm concerned, if you violate this first part of that first procedure, then you're open meat with me. Sorry. But once you jump the rails and you go from him alone plus emails to everyone, you just violated the law of Christ. And therefore, you are to be confronted in public. Because you've gone public. You sidestepped the procedure. If he shall hear thee, thou hast gained thy brother. Well, if you go to him one-on-one And he realizes, like we just got done showing, the sin of ignorance versus the sin of presumption. What if this brother doesn't realize that he's offended you? Maybe he said something or did something, and he was just doing it like a joke, but you took it the wrong way. He walks away thinking, hey, it was just a joke. You are now stewing. Well, then go to him. Go to her. Let them know. They may not know. It is possible, based on the Old Testament, to do something without knowing that you offended someone. Nobody in the church is a mind reader. We all flunked mind reading in high school. And that was not an elective in your courses, in your final year of high school. Now, I'm going to be blunt here this morning, because we've seen the misuse of this even in our church. If he hears you, and he realizes, well, I should not have said that. I did it in jest, but I didn't really, I really didn't mean it to hurt anybody. But you've been hurt, and so I must apologize and ask for your forgiveness. Well, then it should end. All the emails should stop. But most Christians will go home, get the little black book, and they'll annotate time and date. And I'll just simply save that for the next experience. And then they have this letter with all these accusations that are supposedly been addressed and forgiven, but they're going to bring it up. We've seen that in this church. But if he will not hear thee, and this part was never done, then take with thee one or two more, that in the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And beloved, that's from Numbers 35:30. That's an Old Testament principle. My word. Isn't it amazing that everybody wants the pastor, and everybody wants the Sunday school teacher, and everybody wants the deacons to go by the Bible, to go by the letter of the law? Well, here's the letter of the law. In the mouth of two or three witnesses, everything is to be established. Numbers 35:30. And if he shall neglect to hear them. Now, verse 17, you come to the third and final platform of this procedure. Tell it unto the assembly. Tell it unto the church. If this person neglects to hear the church, then let him be unto thee as a heathen man and a publican. Now, somebody very wise in our congregation brought forth a very interesting suggestion. How do we treat heathen and publicans? Don't you share the gospel with them? We're told to treat them as a heathen man and a publican. What do you do for the sake of a heathen man? If this person is viewed upon as the church as an unbeliever, or treat him such, do you forever banish him from your prayers, from your concern? What about a visit to the coffee shop and try to make another appeal as a brother in Christ? Verily I say unto you, whosoever ye shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatsoever ye shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Again I say unto you, if two or three shall agree on earth as touching anything that they shall ask, it shall be done for them of my Father which is in heaven. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them. And beloved, verses 17 to 20 is in the context of church discipline. Now, take this, hold your place, turn to 1 Corinthians 5. If you ought to view this person, you've exhausted this three-tier procedure, and this person neglects to hear the church, then you ought to treat them as a heathen and a publican. Well, notice this, verse 9. I wrote unto you an epistle not to company with fornicators. Yet not altogether with the fornicators of this world, not the bad sinners, or with covetous, or extortioners, or with idolaters. And Paul tells you why. If you divorce yourself from these type of scummy, nasty people, that for then must ye needs go out of the world. You might as well get in a ship and move to the moon. You know why? There's a whole lot of people who are described in verse 10. All around you, your neighbors, your co-workers, maybe some in the church. There's a whole lot of bad, nasty people all around you. And if you want to be so separated from such people, then you got to find yourself another planet. Next, but now I have written unto you not to keep company if any man that is called a brother be a fornicator, covetous, idolater, a railer, or a drunkard, or an extortioner, with such a one, know not to eat. Those are the ones that you are to separate yourself from. Now, I may be on a very tiny limb on the tree, but I think Matthew chapter 18 here is treating maybe much lesser items than these glaring ones. I mean, that is quite glaring, verses 10 to 11. That's in your face. That's like the guy in 1 Corinthians 5. Matter of fact, this is found in that fifth chapter. In chapter 5, Paul didn't do one-on-one, did he? He didn't take two or three other members of the Corinthian church. He wasn't even in Corinth. And since the church took no action, Paul goes right for the jugular and removes him and turns him over to the devil, bypassing Matthew 18. So maybe Matthew chapter 18 is dealing with maybe other issues within a church family. Issues that do not need this type of drastic action. Because Jesus doesn't delineate what the offense is. What is the trespass? Well, I think if one church member, if one guy in the church takes to bed a woman in the church who's married to another guy, you don't need step one, step two. You need step three. You need to simply counsel them, find out what's going on, try to assist, but if they're obstinate with their sin, you get rid of them. I got no problem with that. Because Paul delineates fornicator, covetous, idolater, a railer, a drunkard, an extortioner. I mean, he gives you a list, a real bad, bad list of sins that were quite prevalent in that first century, and beloved, quite prevalent now in the 21st century. I just find it amazing that Paul here doesn't bring up Matthew 18, does he? Paul doesn't tell them in this letter, I'm going to be on the sideline now, and I want you to have one-on-one, and when this fornicator doesn't agree, then I want two or three of the guys of that Corinthian church to take him on, and when that doesn't happen, I want you to take him to the church, and if he blows the church off, then you write me. Show me Paul's appeal to Matthew 18. The church didn't do anything. They didn't even do step one. But because of the magnitude of the sin, Paul simply says, I've turned them over. I'm an apostle. I have that authority. Simply turns them over to the devil, for the devil to play with him. Until he came to his senses, which apparently he does. And in the second letter, now Paul got to deal with the church who won't take him back in. That's just come to my light. Is Matthew 18 dealing with that type of a trespass that's mentioned in 1 Corinthians 5? Paul makes no appeal. And Paul was aware of Matthew 18. So maybe Matthew chapter 18, verses 15 and following, deals with, you know, some of those shoulder bumpings that we do. Off-color joke. Maybe not returning the lawnmower after 5 months, cobwebbed in someone's garage. Or simply just a falling out. but I don't think measuring up to what we find in 1 Corinthians 5. Now, again, I may be off my rocker, but that's my understanding right now. You can either take it or put it away. Finally, there are three temptations that every judge, anyone who's going to sit in a tribunal, even when it comes to being on a jury. So here's some application. You might be called to jury duty. And you're going to sit in that jury box, realizing that someone's life might be in your hands. You're talking maybe a long prison sentence, or maybe death. Three sins. One is the sin of injustice. The sin of injustice. Now, I'm running out of time, so all I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the reference, and you can go back later and check it up. On committing injustices, I advise you to read Proverbs 17:26 and Proverbs 18:5. Beloved, there are a lot of injustices going on today. We read of stories of individuals who have spent 20, 30, 40 years behind bars, and now because of DNA, we come to find out that these individuals were not guilty of a crime, that they were sentenced to that many years in prison, maybe as a very young person. And you see these beautiful stories of them walking out of prison, bald-headed or even gray-headed, being reunited with a wife or with children that they only saw on weekend visits. Now they're free. They've been exonerated. So we do know that injustices can occur. So if you're on the jury, you take all the notes you need. Ponder all the evidence, knowing that that person's life is in your hand. How about this? You might be the one in the box on trial. Would you not want that jury? Do you not want that judge? Do you not want your lawyer to be a just man? Woman? Second temptation, bribes. We're told everybody has a price. What did we read in Proverbs? Man or day, for a morsel of the bread, I'll vote any way you want me to, buddy. I'm hungry. Check out Proverbs 17:23. Check out Exodus 23:8. Check out Isaiah chapter 1, verse 23, and Isaiah chapter 33, verse 15, and Amos 5:12 at your leisure. And then finally, and here's one, beloved, that everybody needs to be very careful, even in church discipline, the sin of being partial, the sin of partiality. This one, we're going to look at quickly. Turn to James chapter 2. Now, why would James mention this if Christians are simply perfect with halos and wings? He is writing to Christians. He's not writing to lost people. And what does he tell them in verse 4? Are ye not then partial in yourselves and have become judges of evil thoughts? Hearken, my beloved brethren, hath not God chosen the poor of this world rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom, which he had promised to them that love him? But ye have despised the poor. Do not rich men oppress you and draw you before the judgment seats? Do they not blaspheme that worthy name by which you are called? Wow, this almost sounds like 1 Corinthians chapter 6, being hauled off to the court. The church members hauling off other church members, put them on trial in front of the atheists and the agnostics of the first century. But notice, are ye not then partial? For he says in verse 2, if there come unto we our assembly a man with a gold ring and goodly apparel, and there come in also a poor man in vile raiment, maybe he smells of urine, he hasn't shaved in several months, and ye have respect to he that wears the gay clothing, the fashionable, you know, flashy-dashy, bling-bling, and say unto him, hey, buddy, sit thou here in a good place, and say to that poor person, stand thou here, or sit under my footstool. Are ye not then partial in yourselves, and have become judges of evil thoughts? Now, why would he say that? He's not talking to pagans. He's not talking to barbarians. He's talking to my brethren in verse 2 of chapter 1. So there they are. Also, okay, for the sins of bribery, Leviticus 19:15, Job 13:10, the oldest book of the Bible, Malachi 2:9, and look at 1 Timothy 5. We're right here, 1 Timothy 5:21. Look at this. I charge thee before God and the Lord Jesus Christ and the elect angels that thou observe these things without preferring one before another, doing nothing by partiality. He ain't talking to thugs. He's talking to Christians. See, we can become guilty of being partial and preferring one brother or one sister over the other. I don't like sitting with them. They don't like me. Well, how do you know that? I just know that. I don't want to be around them. So there it is. So the next time someone tells you, never talk religion and politics, you ought to tell them. My pastor just got done preaching a little series on that. Jesus mentions both. And the New Testament writers bring up good government, bad government, sound religion, pagan, false, idolatrous religion. You can talk about both. You have a green light to bring up those two subjects when the need arises and the context is given to you. May God choose to bless his word. Amen.